this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. The most engaging six words ever spoken over the course of human history go like this. Let me tell you a story. And someday you're going to need those words. Maybe at your wedding as you explain how your love began. At your father's funeral as you give the eulogy. Maybe just around the campfire. Or even in front of investors as you describe why you started your business. Now today's guest is an epic storyteller and a dear, dear friend of mine. A man named John Romaniello, and he's going to teach you how to tell better stories. He's written the New York Times bestselling book, Man 2.0, Engineering the Alpha. He's a writing coach, a former fitness model, a super funny guy from Long Island, and a guy that can get away with teasing me on this podcast as he does. So John lives in Manhattan now, and I'm going to be straight up and blunt with you. He likes to tell a few salty tales. But I asked him not to curse on the show, and even though he does about five times, but who's counting, please forgive us, okay? Please forgive us. The bottom line is you simply can't miss a minute of his storytelling secrets, including how he used his skills to share the story of his depression, suicide attempts, and his healing, and how he shows you how to use the tough times in your life to tell the best stories and create the life of your dreams. This is a powerful episode. It's one that gave me goosebumps several times as John and I sat in the basement recording studio of his condo in New York City. Hi, this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio, and today's show reveals how you can and must share your hero's journey. Through storytelling. You'll want to listen to this epic episode at least twice, if not three times or more, because it is so great. John and I just sat down on the couch and we rapped. It was so good. And so this episode is jam-packed with gold nuggets about becoming a better coach, about attracting better people into your life, and what to do when you meet a crisis. And the spoiler is to answer the phone and answer the call just like John did and take up the gauntlet that has been thrown down in your life. So listen, if you love books and movies and stories and legendary tales, you're going to love this show. Again, it was recorded in the recording studio of John's fancy condo in Manhattan. So it's about as New York City hipster as you can get. And yeah, I even had a beard, and so did John. And it was the perfect setting for our discussion. Now, speaking of books and vulnerable stories, Early to Rise Radio is brought to you by The Perfect Day Formula. It's my best-selling book about how I had to overcome my anxiety attacks so that I could learn how to own the day and control my life. And now I teach you to do the same, to overcome your most difficult obstacles and transform your life. Get your free copy at perfectdaybook.com or download the audiobook from Amazon so that you can keep the momentum and motivation going. All right, John, we are now in the basement recording studio of your new apartment in New York City. This has been quite a journey since we first met in a steakhouse or something in Tampa, where I watched you. Actually, we met one night at a restaurant, and then the next night we went to Shula's restaurant in Tampa, where I watched you consume some 40-ounce steak in about a minute and a half.
I'm not sure it was that quick, but it was fast.
It was incredibly fast. So, John, tell me and tell our listeners about who you were back then in 2009. It's almost been a decade now. Goodness. And who you are today.
Sure. In 2009, I'm going to give like the abridged version because this has been, you know, printed and everywhere. So I don't want anyone who is listening to be fraught with redundancy. But in 2009, I was in the midst of my quarter-life crisis. I was a personal trainer. in New York City and on Long Island, and I was doing very well. I was, you know, clearing six figures, doing, but I wasn't.
And modeling a bit.
And yeah, doing some modeling. And so the main thing for me was that when I was maybe 24, I had made the business very successful, and I had cleared like 125 for the first year. And then, but by the time, like 4 or 5 years later, 4 years later, I guess, I was doing the same thing. And so I was in this strange period where nothing was ostensibly wrong. Things were good, but they weren't changing. There was not a lot of forward motion. And I began to start to question, you know, I'm only a couple of years shy of 30. Am I going to want to get up at 6:30 in the morning for the rest of my life, or whatever it is? And, you know, training is this really like amazing thing where you get to help people, and, but you are, as you've talked about probably ad nauseum, exchanging time for dollars. And it's very much a young man's game. And then you begin to feel all of a sudden, what does this look like 15 years from now? And so I began to look at some other options. At that point, I was thinking about buying a gym or taking a bigger part of a gym. I had been ignoring my passions for a really long time. I grew up, I was a writer first and everything else second. And I just sort of fell into writing about fitness for T Nation and then really jumped into the training thing because it was what made the most money. And now I'm 27 years old and I think...
Well, actually, let's back up a little bit,
sure.
You know, to your writing time. You know, you have a real cool background. You know, you like a certain type of music. You like Dungeons & Dragons.
Sure.
You also had your own transformation in high school or college that was...
Yeah.
That was very formative, which, you know, maybe give a quick background of that, because that led to your writing and your books and all that sort of thing.
Right. So, okay, we'll backtrack. I grew up being a bookish sort of guy, very nerdy. I read a lot. I learned to read by having people read Lord of the Rings to me. I am covered with very nerdy tattoos. I was the kid who, I didn't even have the good sense to be a nerd in private. In the eighth grade, I played Magic the Gathering in like the high school cafeteria or the middle school cafeteria, which is a very like visible way of being a nerd. And it wasn't that I was thumbing my nose at the popular kids. I just didn't know better. I wasn't even smart enough to, you know, be ashamed of it, which I would now say never be ashamed of who you are. But at the time, so I wound up playing sports in high school primarily as a way to diversify my resume for my college applications. No one in my family had ever gone to college, so it was very important that I go, and I needed to go to a good school. And so most of my high school career was very academically driven. I played some sports. I was never, you know, a stud athlete. I was never in great shape, but playing sports does keep you fitter. And then when I was in college, I had achieved the goal of getting to a good school, and then I stopped doing those things. And probably the second semester of my freshman year of college, I looked in the mirror and I was like, that's not going to work. I didn't feel that who I was internally was reflected in the mirror. And I, again, being a nerdy guy, I grew up like looking at visions of Conan the Barbarian and Wolverine and all of these imaginary characters who were disproportionately fit. But I also just, you know, thought, while that might be a little unrealistic, I probably don't need to be chubby anymore. And so I dove in, read every book I could find, and then went through a body transformation. So I was 19 to 20 years old at this point, and I lost all the weight very quickly. It turns out I am genetically gifted in terms of fitness, and that changed my life in a lot of dramatic ways, particularly the way that other people interacted with me, certainly women, but also all of a sudden you have this skill set where guys are treating you with respect and asking you for advice and asking you to help them change. And I found that quite to my liking. And for me, nothing has ever been real until I write about it. And I was 20 years old and I decided that since I had found T Nation, I was going to write for them. And it was through T Nation that I met our mutual.
And T Nation is a website.
Yes. So T Nation, what was then T Mag, Testosterone Nation, it is one of the largest bodybuilding websites in the world, probably second only to bodybuilding.com. So it's very, at the time, a very reputable source of information.
I mean, it was a huge influence on me. It was the website that I read in 1998.
Yeah.
In the university library because no one actually had computers at home. And I was like, oh, I can do this. I can write articles on the internet. And that website, finding that website that day led me to, you know, I guess where I am now.
Turbulence training. Yeah, that's the inciting event, as they say. So through T-Nation, I met a lot of our mutual friends, Joel Marion. And that sort of dovetails very nicely going back to the prior story where I was 27, looking for something new. I had been writing a little bit about fitness. I'd done some fitness modeling. I was training. But now I sort of realized I need to look at the future, and I hadn't been doing that. Maybe I'll go back to school. Maybe I'll do this. And then as luck or fate would have it, Joel gave me a call, and he had he said, I'm getting involved in internet fitness and kind of sort of explained the – from a high level internet marketing to me. He didn't have a firm enough grasp on it when he sort of discussed it with me. I was like, I don't know, man. I don't think it's going to work. And then he like came back to me after his first launch. He was like, hey, man, I just did like $300,000 in a week. Yeah. I'm like, all right, now I'm listening.
Yeah, and so, Joel Marion, for our listeners, is a very good friend of mine. I'm sure everybody has heard the name or seen me write about Joel. Mm-hmm. He's like a brother to me and one of Roman's best friends. We were both in Joel's wedding back in the day. And Joel is one of the best internet marketers in the world, probably. Yeah. And so now, if he talks, you listen. Yes. But back then, he was just Joel.
He was just Joel. He was like, you know, Joel and I met when we were 19 years old, bunch of meatheads. He was from Jersey. I was from Long Island. And you know, his verbal copywriting was not good enough to sell me on the idea. Hmm. But once he had some social proof in the form of this very successful launch, he brought me along for the ride, which is very nice. And I think it's very much like John Lennon going back for Ringo. I'm Ringo in this case. I could have said Paul, but I feel like my egotism only goes so far. No disrespect to Ringo if you're listening or Ringo fans. And so I went to a marketing event with Joel. The very first marketing event I ever went to was in Wyckoff, New Jersey, called Fast Track to Fitness Millions.
Oh, yeah.
And that is where you and I met briefly in a hallway for maybe 3 minutes. Yeah. And then Joel and I, you know, we were there for the weekend. I learned a lot. I met guys like Jason Capital and David Sinek. Jason Capital now runs a very, very successful business. David Sinek runs paleohacks.com, which is huge, and a number of other dudes who have and women who have become massively successful in the interim. I started my first website, romanfitnesssystems.com, in a hotel room in Wyckoff, New Jersey in May of 2009, and thus began my entry into the world of internet fitness. I started writing articles and blogs, and things began to pick up pretty quickly. I had a lot of great guidance from guys like Joel and some others. And then I want to say in June of – or July of that year, we found ourselves in Tampa.
No, that was – I think it was October.
Oh, was it – wow. Was that late? Okay, so it was October of 2009. We found ourselves in Tampa. And this is my first real experience with Craig Ballantyne. And
what do you remember about this experience?
Well, there's a couple of things.
Because I thought it went okay.
one of the things that I thought was so endearing. So at this point, for those who don't know, most people who met Craig assumed Craig hated them because he was – you were at the time, you were not as personable. You allowed your introversion to sort of run the show.
Sure.
And, you know, there was a sort of
It was the beginning. It was the beginning of the hero's journey.
It was just sort of like what seemed to be an intentional disregard for the social mores of interpersonal interaction. And so I remember like one occasion in particular where we were riding up the elevator, and we're in the middle of a conversation, and I was in the middle of a sentence asking you a question, and you were on a lower floor than us. It's the end of the night. We're all going home. And so the elevator's on its way up, and the doors open to your floor. And without saying goodbye to anyone, you just put your head down and walked straight, like beelined out of the elevator. And I was standing there with my mouth open, and I just laughed and loved it. I was like, this guy is amazing. This guy is cool. And everyone else seemed to think that you were rude or weird. I'm like, I don't know, man. He just doesn't want to talk. And so then We wound up at
a we got along pretty quickly.
We did, yeah. We wound up at a steakhouse. And at this point in my life, strange it is, I had never been to Canada. And I peppered you with questions about Canada. And friends at home, Craig Ballantyne lied to me for like 2 days straight about Canada. For context, this is 2009. We had smartphones, but it wasn't immediately your impulse to fact check everything everyone said. And so if somebody was from Canada and they said that,
we don't have roller coasters.
So he's like, we don't have roller coasters. And I said, what, really? He said, yeah, no, it's too cold. The tracks will freeze. And I said, that doesn't make sense. You have summer, right? How warm does it get in the summer? And he looks at me and he says, it gets to be like 9 degrees. And I said, what? And then I was clearly confused, and he clarifies with, oh, no, well, Celsius. I'm like, okay, still, that's not, it has to be warmer than that. It's, and he goes, no, it doesn't. It's Canada. And I was like, oh, well, he's the expert. And so there was a lot of myths about Canada being just shared around that. But yeah, so that was our experience. And, I was very taken with you. I thought it was.
I warmed up to you pretty quick because you are very entertaining and you're a great storyteller.
Thank you.
You are. And so, we'll get to kind of like, you've had an amazing career and you've written books and now you do tons of great coaching and you're a writing coach and all this stuff. But you're such a naturally gifted, it seems like you're a naturally gifted storyteller at heart. Mm. Why don't you tell us, because everybody needs to be a better storyteller in their writing and in their funeral speeches and everything that life throws at us. So how does one become better at storytelling?
I think that this is a really terrible answer. It's the same way you get better at anything else. Mm-hmm. You break it down so that you can understand the structure and the process of it. And then you practice those individual things piecemeal, and then you stack them on top of one another. I was very fortunate that I grew up loving stories. I love to read, and the types of stories that I read, I was, again, very much into Dungeons and Dragons. And so, growing up reading Dragonlance or Forgotten Realms or all of these other books that were published by TSR, the parent company of Dungeons and Dragons, they sort of just ingrained in my head a certain way of doing things in terms of process.
I think you make a very good point there in that you break it down first.
Yes.
Like you mentioned that as the first step. Yes. Now, I like to read books, and a lot of people read a lot of books, but it's the same as, well, I watch a lot of movies. It doesn't make you a good movie director or anything.
No.
But you were the first person to me who really talked about hero's journey and the different phases and all these things. And I was just Googling it the other day for a friend because, you have that stuff down pat, but nobody else thinks about that. So talk us a little bit about that.
Well, to sort of button up what I was saying, I got very much into Dungeons and Dragons, and I started being a dungeon master. And the dungeon master is the guy who controls all of the monsters and the non-player characters. And so you're sort of the narrator and the author and the storyteller, and your friends sitting around the table might, this guy's a wizard and that guy's a thief. But your job is to guide them through the adventure. And I started writing these adventures after running a few. And this is the thing that began me, that sort of set my feet on the path towards learning storytelling. Every Dungeons and Dragons adventure more or less starts the same way. And it always begins with, you're sitting in an inn and somebody comes in distress and has some issue. A daughter has been kidnapped. There's a marauding dragon, something. And so in Campbellian storytelling, this is the inn is what's called the ordinary world. It's where you exist. And then this thing that happens is the inciting event or call to adventure.
And Campbellian is Joseph Campbell.
Joseph Campbell, right. So I'll touch on that in a minute.
Okay.
And so another piece that is very traditional for not only Dungeons and Dragons, but everything that is sort of derivative or precedent of it. Lord of the Rings, for example. You know, for those who haven't seen the movies or read the books, that's weird to me, but you have all of these different character archetypes. You have Legolas, who's played by Orlando Bloom. He's an elf. He has a bow and arrow. You have Gimli, who is a dwarf. And so you have all of these.
I know most of this stuff through the game Gauntlet.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so Gauntlet or World of Warcraft or Final Fantasy. Ultimately, there's a sort of understanding that there are needs for different archetypes to solve different types of problems, right?
Kind of like the Avengers at the same time, too.
Very similar, right? So, you know, you can be a knight with a big suit of armor and a big sword, and you're very good if the goblins attack, but if you wind up needing to go down a hallway and it's full of booby traps, disarming those is the job of your ranger or your thief or whomever else. Oh. And this is all D&D related stuff that I mentioned.
Because, also like Ocean's 11.
Yes, very, yes, all of these things. But, and the reason that Ocean's 11 and Dungeons and Dragons and the Lord of the Rings and the Avengers all sort of you can find analogs in each one. It's because this is not just something somebody decided. It's the way that we learn. Which brings us to Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell was a professor of mythology at Sarah Lawrence University, and he studied comparative mythology, which means he looked at myths across cultures and focused on where they converge rather than where they diverge, and so what they had in common. And he began to see that whether you are talking about, you know, Jesus or Krishna or the Buddha, all of these stories have very, very similar archetypes and a very similar structure. And, you know, zooming out to our day and age, whether we're talking about Dorothy Gale or Luke Skywalker or Harry Potter or Daniel LaRusso.
Is Dorothy from
The Wizard of Oz?
Okay. Didn't know her last name.
All of these characters go through similar journeys. And so he did not invent the idea of the monomyth or hero's journey. He just sort of looked at it and codified it because the reason that all of these stories exist in this way is because that is how we as human beings have passed knowledge down from generation to generation in our oral and written traditions, you know, going back to Gilgamesh, going back to any of our messianic traditions. And so I discovered Campbell when I was in college, but prior to that, I was learning how to write. I was reading all these stories about Dungeons and Dragons and, you know, the ordinary world. You're sitting in an inn and then there's an inciting event. That is the same way we can tell a story now, right? And so in much the same way, I was 27 and I was having a quarter life crisis. My ordinary world was I was a trainer and I wanted something different. And then there's the call to adventure. In this case, it was a literal phone call from Joel Marion, who said, I have this opportunity. And then there's a step called the refusal of the call. And I said, Joel, I don't think that I'm ready for that or whatever. And then you know, usually there's crossing the first threshold. I went to Fast Track to Fitness Millions. There's a stage called Meeting with the Mentor, which is when I met, you know, you and Mike Geary and all of these other people who began to mentor me and lead me all the way through these various stages. And so this is not me like retrofitting something to my past experience. This is how we experience just about every major change in our life. And I was very, very fortunate to study Campbell in school. I was also very fortunate to have a friend who encouraged me to do stand-up and improv when I was in college. And I mention those things because if you really want to see some of the best storytellers in the world, watch stand-up. That is really where some of the most incredible stuff happens. It's unreal. Probably, I mean, there are a lot of great comics whose names we can no longer mention because they have done some disreputable things. But probably one of the comics who I think really does a great job, if you go back to maybe 2006 or 7 and watch Dane Cook's Retaliation, and you can, one of the great things about it is listen to that album. And despite the fact that you can't see Dane, you know exactly how his body is moving. You know the faces he's making. You know the way he's gesturing aggressively with his limbs because you can hear it in his voice. And when you can visualize someone in terms of their actual like kinesthetic movement, just from the from what they're saying and the way they're saying it, that is pretty remarkable. So I did some stand-up, and I got good at addressing a room of people. And then I studied Campbell, and I learned what makes a story. And the Campbellian tradition, the hero's journey, has 17 stages. I like the abbreviated version that is outlined in Christopher Vogler's The Writer's Journey, Mythic Structure for Writers.
How many stages are in that one?
12.
Okay, that's the one I Googled the other day, yeah. And there was 12.
So there's a few things that are taken out. And, you know, there's in a lot of the more traditional stories, there is a lot of the stuff about women is kind of wrapped up in interesting stuff. There's woman as temptress, which is this stage where the, you know, this succubus would try to like sort of derail the hero from his quest and, right. You know, stay home. Don't, you know, like stay home, Achilles, don't go and fight this war. I've seen that you will die. And so
would it be the same as the sirens and the boat part, or is that different?
That's different. Yeah. But I mean, it's the same, that is ultimately the same thing, right? The siren, they're calling you away from your quest and you know, dash you on the rocks and the whole bit. So that tends to be a little bit less present in, modern storytelling, particularly on screen. Instead, we focus on another stage, which is woman as the goddess. And so the in a traditional heteronormative film, the female lead is very much the treasure, but also she is the goddess in that she encourages the hero to grow. She's the muse. She, you know, and so, you know, people tend to inhabit all these different archetypes.
So I got a question.
Yeah.
I could know the formula. Mm-hmm. What makes a great story versus a formula? I have my idea, but I want to hear yours.
If you are writing it, the thing that makes a really, really great story is the same thing that makes really, really great sales copy. You have to know your audience, and you have to talk to them the way that that audience likes to be spoken to. And you also you have to make some assumptions, but you can't make all of the wrong assumptions. A lot of your assumptions need to be correct. And so when you are writing or telling a story, the first piece of it, I break my storytelling, the way that I teach storytelling into six steps. And the first piece of this is the frame. And when you establish the frame, you are creating that ordinary world before something happens. And I tend to think that this is where people mess up the most in terms of storytelling because they don't give the necessary information. So, for example, when I'm telling the story about going to Fast Track to Fitness Millions, I always specifically mention Wyckoff, New Jersey. And I always say it like, it's in, of all places, Wyckoff, New Jersey. No, most people haven't heard of Wyckoff. And the most important thing there is that I'm communicating to you that I went to this weird place in New Jersey.
Like Tatooine.
Because I was desperate enough, I was ready to make a change that I went to this crazy place. Like, you know, like when you're on Tatooine and Luke is going to go with Obi-Wan, he goes to Mos Eisley Space Station. And you know, Obi-Wan describes it as a more reprehensible connection of scum and villainy you will never find or something like that. And this certainly wasn't the Fast Track to Fitness Millions. But my point is when I say Wyckoff, New Jersey, and I say it in that tone, I am implying to the listener, great information can be found in the most unlikely of places. Okay. And so when you're creating the frame, it is really important to know where your audience is coming from. And I mentioned that this happened in 2009. Now, anyone who was doing internet-related stuff in 2009 probably has some dim awareness, but things in terms of technology advanced so quickly, it is often important to sort of restate why it's important that it's 2009, right? In 2018, the internet is faster, phones are faster, they're always in our hands.
2009, you're still using flip cams to do the videos,
exactly.
Right? Remember those flip cams?
Yeah. And so that is important context, because when I tell the story about you lying to me about Canada, it wasn't yet an ingrained instinct in 2009 to look up, does Canada have roller coasters? You just sort of...
You would have had to go back to your room.
Right. And so that... So the frame requires that you give enough information about the time it took place that it's relevant to the story. If, you know, if I were to say, okay, I went on a date last week with a woman who lived on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or in Brooklyn, whatever. And so if I'm telling a New Yorker that story, and they know that I live in Hell's Kitchen, they have an automatic and inherent understanding of the fact that, like, while Hell's Kitchen and the Upper East Side of Manhattan are on the same island, they are two very different worlds. Right. And it's just like, you know, there's no easy way to get there by subway. It's a whole fucking thing. If they know me, they're like, oh, you went to Brooklyn? This girl must be amazing. I don't go to Brooklyn. And so, but if I'm telling someone who isn't from New York, I need to create the context for them that this woman is from a place that is very difficult to get to.
And I think this is so important, not just for writing.
For sales.
But, well, and for the next time somebody does a best man speech.
Oh, sure.
Because I've been at weddings where everybody just assumes you know everything about the groom, or you know everything about us guys, and it becomes a 3-minute inside joke that nobody gets.
Right.
And this context and the way that you said, like, even when you said Upper East Side, I read enough of the New York Times and I'm familiar with New York and I've watched enough television shows. I'm like, oh, you went, that's odd.
Yeah, that's very far.
And there'd be snooty women up there. I couldn't imagine you going out with a snooty woman.
Right. And so that contextually makes sense to you. But to someone whose entire experience of New York City comes from movies and Sex in the City, they don't know that, you know? And so I have to give them that background. So the frame is essentially establishing the time, the place, and the circumstances around the beginning of the story. And you can do this in a very simple way. For example, if something happened, you know, when we met in 2009, if I just want to tell that story quickly, I can just say 2009, but it's when I tell the story of how I had a very quick ascent in terms of internet marketing prowess and success. I always mention that I started my website. I think it was like May 24th in a hotel room, and then we launched the product on February 15th of 2010. So it's really 7 months, and so to go from starting a website in a hotel room to doing a $500,000 launch in 7 months, that time period, that's necessary for the story.
Sure.
You know? And when, in terms of being descriptive, in terms of helping people see the story, there's a very big difference between saying in 2009 in New York City or Jersey versus fall of 2009 or October of 2009, right? When I say October, you think Halloween, you think orange, you think gold, you think leaves changing. If I had said December, you'd think snow, you'd think Christmas. So having that one word in there in terms of the frame creates a pretty visceral visual for people from where they can sort of like build the visual of the story.
And that's so important, is allowing the reader, viewer, listener to build their own story.
Right, to fill things in. And so you want to give enough guideline that, like, you know, listen, if you live in Australia and I say January, that's summer for you. It's not, you know, but if you, most people in the Western Hemisphere, particularly in North America, they're going to be like, okay, it's cold, you know.
So I got a question. That was your answer, that I would have said something like, character development and describing the character. How important is that in making a great story? And is that, can that make up for a lot of other failures, I suppose? Or is that what, you know, is that what sets apart something like Luke's, you know, Star Wars? Or is it just the power of that story is so
good? Well, the power of the story is, it far supersedes Luke. I mean, Luke is not a particularly great character, you know, like just looking and disregarding the newer movie, but looking at Luke in terms of his attributes as a character, he's a little bit whiny. He is arrogant, undeservedly. He says really ridiculous things. You know, there's this one point where they're on the Millennium Falcon on their way to Alderaan, or thinking they are. And he says to Han Solo, he's like, "You don't believe in the Force?" I'm like, dude, you learned about that shit 3 days ago. like you've been training as a Jedi for exactly one scene. And, you know, Luke, you know, his character development is interesting. You know, by the time he's in Jedi, you know, he's a more fully formed character. But these character flaws are what make him interesting. And by the time you get to Empire, Yoda glaringly points them out. You know, and he, you know, Yoda is like, "This one long time have I watched, never paying attention to what he was doing, always his eyes on the horizon." Luke's a dreamer. He's not, you know, you don't want a dreamer in charge of your war. You want a guy who's like very focused. You don't want a big picture guy in charge of the war. You want a detail oriented guy, you know, or woman, General Leia. And so, you know, there's all these things, like they're not, the characters don't have to be overly strong if they're recognizable. We all recognize Luke. You know, he is the protagonist, and he can almost be what we call an empty vessel character. Luke can almost be a character who is void of really deep development, because that would allow us to inhabit him and experience the story through him. Harry Potter is an interesting example because it's the story is told from the point of an omnipotent narrator, but it's like 3/4 experiential. So we are learning information as Harry learns it. You know, it's the as Harry as it is revealed that Voldemort is the heir of Slytherin. As he learns that, that is how we find that piece of information. As it is revealed that Sirius Black is his godfather, as Harry finds that information out by spying in Hogsmeade, that's when we learn that information. But because of that, the way that the story is told, it's also, you know, it's never Harry looking in the mirror and seeing a tear streak down his face. It's always a description of of Harry's experience of crying. And so we get to inhabit Harry a little bit, but we also have so much of his internal monologue that he is a very fleshed out character, and you get to see his flaws. So character development is is hugely important if the story is deep and more character driven. Most of the time, we as humans, we think in archetypes, right? And so I'll reference Louis C.K. I apologize. I know that we're not supposed to say his name and invoke anyone who has done the things he does, but he's a great comedian. And when he brings up his daughter, and you know, this is going back years ago, when he brings up his daughter and the fact that she's 5 years old and he walks in and he walks home from work and she's just lying on the floor naked, that's all the description you need to understand that she is one of those 5-year-olds who doesn't like to wear clothes, and she probably has a lot of energy, and she's very sort of rambunctious and probably doesn't like to listen to direction. So just that little snippet gives us enough of her character to like allow us to walk through the rest of that joke, whatever it may be. So the character development is important relative to how involved that character is in the story. Most of the time, we're okay having a few broad strokes.
What about in terms of sales copy and stuff like that? If, you know, if you're telling a story about yourself, like when you told yours in your first sales copy, or if you tell it about a client or a success story, how deep does one need to go there?
I think that you want to go deeper there because you want to make that character fleshed out and you want to help people understand their struggles. So when you say, if you're telling a story about your client, Mary, and Mary is a mother of two. If I'm a mother and I have two young children, I'm immediately going to think, okay, well, Mary's kids are my kids' age. Whereas if I'm, you know, if I'm the mother of two teenage kids, I might put them there. And to accurately describe what Mary goes through in terms of her challenges to her schedule, what restricts her for, you know, like, does she have time to build this business? Having two kids who are like 5 and 2 is very different from having kids who are like 11 and 14. Both hard, super difficult, just a very different set of challenges. And so you need to give enough information to help people visualize what Mary's life is like. You can't just say two kids, you know, two young kids or two teenagers, because that is going to help people really understand. You know, and if you're writing sales copy and she's got teenage kids, you can sort of touch on the fact that, yeah, she's dealing with some separation anxiety and she needs something to fill her time because all she does is drop them off and they hang out with her friends. And then she's sort of constantly worrying about them. But, you know, she has time now. They're not in the house, you know, whereas if she's a mother of a young child or of two young children, it's, you know, she is actively trying to build this business while they're at daycare or away at school. And you paint that picture. And so in terms of her actual characteristics as a person, you know, that's important only if you're trying to speak to someone exactly like her. But when you're, you know, giving the broad strokes of a character, not as much. But yeah, the more detail you give about someone, the better, if it's relevant to everything else. You know, I don't think that a character having a beard because he, you know, is a hipster. I mean, that might be relevant, but you know, like saying someone is ex-military gives you insight about what that person's personality is like.
Got it.
You know?
All right. So we talked about at the start that storytelling to get better at it is getting better at anything. And, you know, you're a writing coach, you know, you can help somebody getting better with storytelling. So just to sum that up, it's to break it down.
Yes.
And then practice it and then probably get feedback and repeat, just like that cycle and that loop, right?
Yeah. And so breaking it down is pretty simple. You know, the first piece is the frame. The second thing is the hook, like what gets the attention. The third piece and the fourth piece can switch, which is it's the deepening and the turn. And so the deepening is where you, like, you take whatever the hook is and you dive deeper into the character or to the story. And, you know, you're just like, you know, the hook is, let me give you guys something that's like really interesting. Okay. So I could say something like in October of 2016, I had a truly interesting experience. I was invited to a party and I thought that it was a party with entrepreneurs and it turned out it was a sex party. And that was, and so that's the hook, right? People are like, oh, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And so the deepening would be me describing what's going on and not necessarily in detail, but just sort of my internal reaction. And then the turn would be that it turns out a lot of people were entrepreneurs. And while I was at the sex party, I met a dude who like turned out to be a good business contact. And then, you know, so you don't expect that. Like once I start deepening and I'm like, this is very strange. There's all these people. And I'm like, I'm asking questions about the way that they live their lives. But oh, it turns out there's a guy who's an app developer. after the turn or the deepening, depending which comes first, there is the pitch or the payoff, depending. So if it's a joke, if it's a funny story, it's the punchline. And if it's something a little deeper, it's like, here's the emotional payoff. If it's sales copy, you can either give them the punchline, give them the bottom line, and then pitch, or you could work your pitch into it, or you could pitch and then button the story up. So, but ultimately, it's frame, hook, turn, deepening, pitch, payoff.
Right on. Okay, so you are, you know, very prolific writer, but you're different than I am in terms of the schedule that you keep and the way that you get things done. So why don't you tell us what works for you?
Sure.
And then we can actually probably fit in. Well, it's not that much different than the way that I work.
Right. So I historically really enjoyed writing at night, and I do enjoy writing at night. And I was for a long time able to make that very, very productive for me. I am sort of a slave to my my muse, and I will cancel everything in my life. If I'm writing and I'm like on a productive sort of swing, I'll cancel everything in my life. I'll bail out on a flight. I skipped a couple of important dinners. I haven't ever had to skip a wedding, but I think I would. So the way that I like to write is I write a lot of things in my head for a while. So I like to make an outline, and I like to write a few things that I know that I want to cover, almost like bullet points. And then I just think about them while I'm doing other stuff. There's something going on in the back of my head. And by the time I get down to my computer, I'm very, very excited to write. I'm pumped to do that. Whenever I, you know, just so that to make this as valuable as possible for people, are you asking about my actual process, like how I get words on page, or are you asking like my schedule?
Day-to-day okay. Schedule.
So I'm a sprinter in that I can take a very fast run at something and then get tired or sick of it, and then I want to switch to something else. And so for me is I can't really work on anything for longer than maybe 2 hours, 3 hours. And that goes for books as well. I was up until recently writing 3 books, and I would just work on one for like a couple of days or a couple of weeks, and I'm like, nah, I don't want to write about this anymore, and then switch to the other one. And I think that is a much slower process. I don't believe in multitasking. I know that it slows you down. But the way I look at it, it's more enjoyable for me and less emotional labor. And I liken it to, I would much rather take a trip that takes me 8 hours to get where I'm going and drive along a beautiful scenic route than drive somewhere and have it take me 6 hours, but I'm sitting in traffic for half of it. And so that is sort of why I make those changes. My day-to-day is, I really don't start working until like 10 or 11 in the morning. Mm-hmm. I get up, take care of my dogs. I read, I do some social media stuff. And then, I've got something partially written from the previous day or night, at least in terms of an outline. And I do my best to write from about 10, anywhere between 10 and 3. So it could be 10 to 1 or 11 to 3. And so, yeah, like 3 to 4 hours of productive writing.
And how do you keep the distractions away during that time?
I have gotten a lot better at this. I really do my, like, I just can't have a phone near me. Mm-hmm. Or if I'm on my phone, which is often the case when I'm traveling, I use stuff like Rescue Time. I'm just very prone to distraction. And I find that the easiest way is to just do things analog whenever I can. And so I like to write a lot of stuff by hand. And then by the time, I mean, I'm probably not going to write like a full post by hand, but I'll write the broad strokes and then a couple of points, and then I just fill stuff in. And so there's a lot of duplication of effort, but I think that I'm getting better work because it saves me the trouble of having to do a first draft. But yeah, I cannot have distractions near me. I cannot have anything make a sound that has a notification. I can't get any dopamine cookies.
So you don't listen to any music?
I listen to music, but I'm one of those weird people who will pick a song and listen to the same song on repeat over and over and over for about 3 hours.
Okay.
So when I wake up in the morning, I have like a classical music wake up playlist that I'm listening to, and that sort of like gets me going, and you know, but I walk the dogs and maybe listen to a podcast. But then when it's time to write, I pick one song and it just plays for 3 hours. And that is why I always have headphones, because I believe to other people that would be very, very upsetting. But again, that is sort of just indicative of my need to really tune out distractions, right? Because right. If you listen to different songs, every song that comes on has different words. It's a different artist, maybe. It evokes different feelings. Whereas if you listen to the same song over and over, it eventually becomes some sort of white noise and you just stop having whatever association you're having with it. It's just a song that moves quickly.
So you've been writing for so long that it would be difficult maybe for you to answer this question, put yourself in that beginner space, but you coach a lot of beginners.
Yes.
So when they're struggling to write, when they're struggling to be productive, how do you coach them through that at the start?
Well, there's two pieces of that question. Are they struggling with productivity and the, you know, it's something in their life that needs to be adjusted in terms of like setting up their process?
Yeah,
or they have writer's block?
Yeah, that one.
Okay. So,
because a lot of people just don't think they have enough ideas. I mean, I'm a very opinionated person, so I'll never have, you know, run out of things to say, but some people do struggle with that.
Sure.
So where do you coach people on that?
The most important thing that I do as a coach is help people understand that you can write about anything and that anything can be made interesting. And I give people assignments. So when people first start with me, I have a 30-day writing schedule and just 500 to 800 to 1,000 words every single day. I want to get people in the groove of writing. And I tell people to turn off autocorrect, to just write it. I don't care what it looks like. I'm trying to grease that groove of writing. But the assignments are all very interesting and some of them are very weird. And they're all just, I don't give a...
So you assign people topics.
I assign people, yeah, there's 30 days of topics. But when I start working with people more deeply, in addition to assigning them a topic, I also assign them a voice.
Okay.
And so for the first 30 days, it's just like five problems with social media or your morning commute, etc. Whereas when I start writing, like really diving into the coaching, an assignment might be, tell me about the first time you laid eye, like the first time you saw your partner. If you're like in a serious relationship, tell me about the first time you saw your partner. But you can't write it from your own perspective. It can't be, you know, I saw her and this is how I felt. You have to write it from the perspective of the omnipotent narrator. So, you know, Craig walked into the bar and saw Deborah, and you have to write it that way. Or it could be that you have to write it as though you are a soldier at war writing a letter to your brother back home. And that changes things because you are maybe writing to him every 2 weeks. So you have to give him context for everything. You have to be descriptive about where you are and what's going on. Whereas if you're just writing for yourself, it's just like, oh, you know, when I first saw her, I had gone to this bar that I used to go, you know, you're not going to give as much context. And so I give assignments that are not only intended to help juice people up and realize that everything in your life is a story. I also train them to write in different voices and different perspectives and different, you know, narrative structures so that they're stretching themselves broadly and laterally in as many ways as possible. Because once you realize that you can tell the story of the first time you saw your spouse from five different perspectives, it's very difficult for you to walk around the world like, not, you know, if you're in a cab and it's a weird ride, that's a story. You think you honestly, anyone who thinks that they don't have stories, that it's hard to find a story to tell, just spend a day taking Ubers. Your Uber driver has stories, man. And yeah. And like, that's, it's crazy.
And you know, it's a really good parallel analogy there between, okay, if you were just writing in one voice, you wouldn't be expanding, you know, your capabilities. Much like if you went to the gym and you only did one exercise, you wouldn't be able to grow your muscles as big and grow your capacity. So I can see that being really, really helpful. How do people, when you set them free, find that voice that's right for them? Is it just a matter of having that experience?
Well, the goal is during our time working together, we help them first find and then hone and then refine their voice. And you begin to see over time what people are comfortable with. Most of my clients are not fiction writers. They're not coming to me to learn to write great dialogue. They are people who are writing, you know, expository things, that like semi-journalistic. They're teaching people other things and they want it to sound more prosaic. They want it to be well-written, informative and entertaining content. And a lot of that is just figuring out how to put you into it, you know, let your personality shine and stop trying to do things that aren't for you. Like, you know, one of the big things is if you're not funny, don't try to be funny. Don't actively make jokes. You can lighten things up, but humor is it's a very specific skill, and understanding setup and all these things, that's a big part of it. If you are not particularly good at writing dry academic articles, don't do that. You don't need to do that just to impress the other people in your field. And so over the course of time, we help people really figure out who they are and how they want to sound or how they need to sound. And one of the examples I always give is someone whose name I think everyone will recognize is Tim Ferriss. And well before I knew Tim, or I considered, you know, we were friends, or before you knew Tim, probably, I watched one of
Tim. Well, you're very good friends because you guys ate 21 scoops of ice cream.
We did. We each ate 21, not a shared 21 scoops.
The Vermonster, right?
Yeah. It was a day, and I remember seeing a talk with Tim that he talked about. Everyone knows that, you know, the 4-hour work week was turned down by 26 out of 27 publishers, blah, blah, blah. But this talk was about him actually writing it. And he said that when he wrote it, the first 4 chapters were written in, quote, epic Princetonian pomposity. Tim is, you know, he's a Princeton grad. And then the next 4 chapters swung the complete opposite way, and they were like silly and goofy and irreverent. And then the 4 chapters after that, chapter like 9 through 12, like he found his voice. And, you know, when you're writing a book, you just like, when you're done with a chapter, you're just like done with it, and then you go back. And it wasn't until he was ready to do edits that he realized he had to rewrite the first 8 chapters and make them sound like him. And that happens. A lot of it is just practice. It's a lot of, you know, it's like if you play golf, you got to take a couple of warm-up swings before you like get in your groove. And it's just, you know, it's the same thing. You just figure it out.
I heard, and maybe this is a rumor, but I heard that he struggled to write the book until he decided to write it as a letter to a friend.
That might be true. Yeah. And that might be how he found that voice. But yeah, I love Tim's writing voice. It's very much informative, but casual. And there are certain, his tone switches depending on the content. And there are things where, and that's another really important thing, right? Like people who read my writing tend to regard it as pretty comedic and entertaining and informative. But when I'm writing about something serious, I treat it with care and respect. And when I wrote the, you know, the very, I don't know if you saw it. I was very, very sick this past June. You remember?
Oh yeah.
And I lost like 30 pounds. And it turns out, you know, I almost died. I was very sick. I had this, this mysterious liver issue, and I wound up in the hospital, and no one was sure what it was. I wasn't drinking a lot at the time, et cetera. And so, about 6 months later, I wrote the story on Facebook, and I think I sent it to my newsletter list as well. And I wrote it in a very funny, playful way, because I realized this is very dark material. And it only affected me, and I'm fine now, so I can treat that playfully. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the piece about my depression, this is a condition that affects millions of people that I do take very seriously. And so that one was written more somberly and in a voice that paid a lot of care to the subject matter. And, you know, there was no point at which I think anyone who also suffers felt disrespected in any way. Everyone was cared for.
Yeah. And so let's take that evolution in how your voice may have changed from writing the fitness stuff at the start to writing serious in-depth stuff about the depression. And even just, and as you tell us that, tell us your story with that and your hero's journey in getting through it.
Sure. In terms of the evolution of the voice?
Evolution of the voice, but also evolution of, you know, how you, sure, you know, acknowledge your depression, work right through it, continue to work through it, because it's not something you don't leave behind.
I think that there is a very clear correlation between the quality of my writing and what I'm willing to talk about. The more open I began to be about the things in my life, the better the writing got, because there's a couple of rules of writing. The first of them is write what you know. Well, you probably know yourself better than you know any other person, and certainly better than any other person knows you. It is, everyone thinks, oh, I don't like writing. No, you don't like writing bios. You don't like writing dating profiles. You don't like writing resumes. Everyone is okay to write a story about something that regarding themselves. And, you know, if you can't, if you feel like you can't write something deep and meaningful, you know, write about what you did on your summer vacation when you were 10 years old. And over time, that helps you get into the type of voice that is very honest. And I think that's the most important thing. You're getting to a place of deep honesty and willingness to vulnerable is a big buzzword. Vulnerability is a big buzzword, and you know, in the internet community, and particularly on Instagram. But it's the willingness
in the TED worlds,
yeah. It's the willingness to share something about yourself, but that doesn't happen automatically. It happens by degrees. I have, you know, consistently made a lot of like funny, very salacious references to sexual stuff throughout my career. But, you know, being willing to make references to my own sexual proclivities is the thing that sort of set the stage for me to be willing to talk about my own perspective on sex in terms of being very accepting and being very sex positive, and that leading me to talk openly about my support for my friends in the LGBTQ community, which sort of led me to be okay talking about, like, you know, in a baseline way, like I guess my overall political beliefs, which are just like, be nice to people and then be responsible with money, hopefully. Yeah. And that eventually led me to the point where I could talk about the things that were specific to me. So it's, you know, you don't just go from writing about fitness to writing about your suicide attempt. There's a number of steps in between, and you slowly share more and more. And some of them can be very low stakes, like your preferences on food and your experiences growing up. And the fact that, you know, I don't know, you were, you know, you played Magic the Gathering in the high school cafeteria. But others are higher stakes, and you know, you can talk about, you know, I've heard you talk a lot about your father's alcoholism. And
I think I can only write about that after I told people that I drank a lot.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, because that's, I think that... That is even far more embarrassing to me than the anxiety stories. Like, my anxiety stories aren't embarrassing to me at all. In fact, they're almost a way of me bragging, saying, hey, look, I didn't always go to bed at 8 o'clock at night. I used to stay up late, and this guy who got anxiety from it. It was more embarrassing for me to talk about my father as an alcoholic, even though everybody could see that he was an alcoholic.
Sure.
But for me to admit that he was an alcoholic and drunk and embarrassing, that was probably the hardest thing I've ever had to write about.
Well, because there's a lot of shame tied to it, right?
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
You have all this stuff, all of these unprocessed emotions from when you were a kid. You know, when you're a kid or a teenager and you don't want to invite people to your house because your dad is an alcoholic and that's embarrassing to you, you got to work through that. Otherwise, like, yeah, your dad's not around anymore and you can have whomever you want over to your house and you don't. But there's still this stuff.
Sure.
You know? And, you know, for me, it was a process of just slowly being willing to open up more and more. And then...
Because it's a turn, right? Because it's a huge turn from here's this fitness model guy.
Yeah.
He's
absolutely
perfect.
Yeah. And the crazy piece was... you know, I don't want to, like, you know, just break down the piece of writing, but there were a lot of things in there that I had never revealed to anyone.
And this is a big essay on depression.
Yeah, it's like 7,500 words. It just outlines my experience with depression.
And you find it on your Facebook and on your website?
Yeah, you could actually just go to romanfitnesssystems.com/depression or just Google John Romanello depression. It'll come up. And the crazy thing is I was diagnosed with depression when I was 17 years old, and I didn't tell a single person until I was 34. So half of my life I had depression, and I just did my best to manage it, and I would hide it, and I would put on this, you know, crazy pantomime of happiness. And it wasn't until, you know, I had a suicide attempt, another suicide attempt, that I realized I have to tell people. And the craziest thing was, it was so much easier for me to write about it, knowing possibly hundreds of thousands of strangers would read it. It was easier for me to do that than to actually sit down and have a conversation with the people in my life.
I would say the same thing about anything I ever revealed, because it's almost like, I guess you would say, like, anybody can anonymously go on the internet and attack somebody, but they would never say that to somebody's face.
Right.
Because there's still, even though you know people are going to read it and they know it's you,
yeah,
it's impersonal in a way.
Right. There's a layer there.
Yeah.
And so I think that the way that you get to, or I got to, being able to write about that stuff was slowly writing about other things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of it is writing about weird, like, meaningless, very strong opinions.
Right.
You know, like...
But once you do that, you go... Oh, well, wait a minute, you know.
I can do this.
Right. Nobody threw a rock at me on the street.
Right.
So I can go to the next level.
Right. Precisely. And I can
go to the next level.
And then, you know, eventually you're talking about your suicide attempts or your divorce or your father's alcoholism or any of the other, you know, like, really painful things. But in order to do those things well, I think it's impossible to write about stuff that important without it coming out as incredibly honest. Mm-hmm. And I think that honesty in writing is the thing that makes it real and hits people, to use internet parlance, in the feels. And I, you know, there were – if you are a writer and if you really care about the craft, there's a lot of stories that – for me, that I wanted to tell, but I didn't, because I knew that I wasn't a good enough writer at the time to do them justice. And so there are things you're going to hold in reserve. Most people, I think, are probably, they need to know how to write. They want to be better writers and communicators, and they're interested in sharing their knowledge and their story. But they're not, you know, sitting up at night agonizing over word choice and you know, but... Yeah, I think that there's so much to be learned from all of it. Every it's amazing to me that, it, as we're sitting here on a podcast, you know, that people believe that writing is no longer relevant, that everything is audio or video. It's just not true. You know, we don't know where things are going. You know, there's a thousand ways to share content, but we do know that people still read the Bible. We do know that people still read Hemingway. We know that they read The Lord of the Rings. And I can't tell you if anyone has, like, recently watched my YouTube videos from 3 years ago or 3 months ago, but I can tell you factually that I still get traffic from articles I wrote 10 years ago.
Hmm. Well, you know, it's funny that we're a few blocks away from Broadway, which is where the new Harry Potter play is out.
Yep.
You know, Harry Potter play came from Harry Potter movies, but there's no movies or no play without Harry Potter books,
right?
First of all, right?
Right.
Okay, so one last thing on the vulnerability thing is, how does that change not just your business, but how has that changed, like, every person that you have taught to write? How has that changed their business, their life, everything?
Dude, it is... I have done very well not dropping F-bombs here, but I will say it is fucking mind-blowing that it's unreal. In terms of changing your impact, writing a piece on depression has given me a level of satisfaction that I have never gotten from anything else, because it's not just that I didn't think it would be anything other than well received, right? You tell the world, hey, I've had all these instances where I was going to kill myself. You pretty much expect everyone's going to say nice things and be like, sure. Yeah, no, it's, you know, and be supportive. What I didn't expect is I hoped that there'd be people with who also suffered from depression who would feel that they weren't alone, and some of that has happened. But the single biggest thing is that people who don't suffer but have someone in their life who does reach out and say, I finally understand what my father is going through or what my husband goes through. Or, you know, I got this one email, my grandfather killed himself 13 years ago and it seemed like everything was great. And this has helped me come to terms with that. And so that level of impact is crazy. And, you know, that directly affecting my bottom line or my business is immaterial. But, you know, I there actually have been a number of people who have signed up for both business and writing coaching because writing coaching for two reasons. One, they may also suffer from depression and they want to learn how to, be able to talk about it. Or two, that was a beautifully written piece and I cannot believe that I read the entire thing. I want to learn how to do that. I want to learn how to write 7,500 words that people read and are disappointed when it ends. Right. And then in terms of the business coaching, I have gotten a lot of people who suffer from depression and they're like, you're the only person I thought would understand. You have to share stuff about your life. It is mind-blowing the reason people sign up with you. Or one of the most – we have sort of an exit form, you know, when people are done with the fitness coaching. You know, I still do online fitness coaching. And one of the things that pops up when we ask, it's just like, okay, well, why did you sign up with me specifically? And an answer that pops up, it's not the depression. It's, well, you talk about bourbon a lot, so I figured you wouldn't make me quit drinking.
Oh, okay.
And so
I thought it was going to be Dungeons and Dragons, to be honest.
That happens a lot. I mean, you know, a lot of times it's music, you know, it's the, like, you know, 2000s emo I listen to. Yeah. A lot of it is D&D. But yeah,
I get a lot of people who grew up on farms.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because people relate to it. But when I got into let's just talk about fitness for a second. When I got into the fitness industry in 2009, it was not common for fitness professionals to talk about drinking alcohol. You know, everyone wanted to be perceived as someone who lived a quote unquote healthy lifestyle all the time. And at that particular juncture, healthy meant, you know, fairly draconian and disciplined. It didn't mean balanced. And I wasn't going to do that. You know, I like bourbon. I like having a glass of whiskey. And I put that out there often enough that people send me recommendations for their favorite bourbon. They ask me for mine. And when they sign up for coaching, they think I'm not going to demonize them for drinking. And, you know, what if any of you are interested in a fitness transformation of any kind, what I tell my clients is, as long as you're willing to give up alcohol for the first 30 days and the last 30 days, you can pretty much mess around in the middle within reason and you're going to be okay. And it's only the last 30 days if you have like a photo shoot or something. But if I had followed the projected path, if I had done what everyone else was doing and not talked about drinking and not done the occasional drunk Q&A, I would say it's probably about 50 or 60 people who have given that reason specifically. And at $400 a month with an average of 6 months, that's a lot of money that I've made because of bourbon. Now, it's also because I'm a great coach and I have all these testimonies, yada, yada, yada. But
it's the thing
it's the thing that pushed them over the edge. It was the catalyst. So, you know, I've had – when you start being more vulnerable, when you start talking about – the things that mean something to you or the things that affect you, it changes your business. I have gotten tons of writing and speaking opportunities because of the depression piece and because I, you know, have spoken about, I'm a very outspoken advocate for equality and in particular, queer rights and women's equality. And you know, I'm going to be speaking at this. I was hired to consult with a company out in Colorado, and just like talk to their C-suite guys about like, hey, here's how to like exist and still work with women without being creepy or, you know, without getting in trouble in the Me Too era. Hmm. And, you know, these are guys, older white guys in their 60s who just need some of this information.
Sure.
And these are opportunities that never would have happened had I not decided to be vocal about the things that I believe in. You know, there's a lot of people who want to remain silent about whatever their beliefs are. I mean, I think like everyone can get behind consent and, you know, not raping people. But, you know, there's a lot of negative connotation that goes with whatever people think feminism means. And but being able to talk about that, being able to talk about the depression, it has changed my business, at least in that it's a huge differentiator. Sure. And I stand out. But in terms of the direct effects, I mean, yeah, it's definitely made me more money. It has gotten me attention where I wouldn't have otherwise had it. And it has helped me help so many more people that I wouldn't have otherwise.
And then that's obviously something that you're going to teach somebody to go and say what needs to be said.
Precisely correct. Right.
To get them to where they need to be.
Precisely. You know, if you have, this is a very dark example. But I have a writing coaching client who, his son passed away when he, so this was 6 years ago. And, but his son was two. And I can't even begin to fathom the idea of losing a child at all, let alone your baby. And I told him, think about how many other people in the world experience that. And they want a voice. They want to be heard. They want to be, you know, and I was like, don't just write about how hard it was. Add value. Write about, this is how to talk to people about it. This is, you know, why you shouldn't avoid the topic. You don't be the person who, you know, as you're walking into dinner with a new person, being like, oh yeah, like this guy's kid died. Like, don't bring it up. Or like, write articles about how to talk about it. Help people understand what it feels like, how you're getting over it. Help the people who have experienced something similar, give them a voice, but also help the people around them understand how to serve. And when you do that, you just elevate everything. And if you can write about, you know, the way your life has changed after losing your child, then you can write about anything.
Yeah, and that's the ultimate in storytelling, is giving other people that, you know, that view into that story, that world, that those feelings,
right,
which make you connect with people.
Truly.
Yeah, absolutely. John, this was fantastic. I learned so much. It was so awesome to hang around you. And now for the storytelling purposes, we are going to wander out into New York City, and you're going to take me to New York's Best Pizza, which everyone can imagine us going somewhere amazing for that. But where will people find more about you? You mentioned romanfitnesssystems.com/depression for that epic post that you have. How can people get a hold of you on social media?
I very cleverly made all of my social media handles my name.
Yes.
They're just at John Romanello. I
like to say it like this. Roman I-L-O.
Yes.
Because that's how you spell it.
Yes.
Roman I-L-O.
Yes.
So I always say it like that.
There is a hidden I in the middle. Yeah. My ancestors didn't drop the I when they made it to Ellis Island. but they should have. But so yeah, it's Roman like the empire, and then I-L-O.
It's
a soft I. Yeah. It's not Roman yellow like you would think. The place that is probably best to get a hold of me is on Instagram. Please shoot me a DM. I'd love to hear from you. I love, if you're super interested in seeing pictures of my dog, you could actually just, that's about what I got going on Instagram. She's adorable. But Instagram DMs are the thing that I'm most likely to see the quickest.
And you coach people in writing.
Yes.
In fitness.
Yes.
And in business.
Yes. Yeah. So the fitness coaching is something that I do because I love it and I don't want to let it go. And it's not the most scalable thing for me right now, but I love it. The business coaching is something, it's one of the reasons you're in town. We do through the Roman Fitness Systems Mastermind, where I work with, a lot of people a lot of people in fitness, but I've worked with musicians and we've had all sorts of cool people. So that's fun. I do direct business consulting as well, but I love the mastermind. I really think that there's a lot to be said for finding, you know, getting in a room of 40 people and finding who your D&D adventuring party is and finding five people in that room in your mastermind who can really help elevate your business. And, you know, whenever I speak at events and I'm on stage, I remember what it was like to be in the back of the room at, you know, in Wyckoff, New Jersey. And, you know, I know you spoke there, mm-hmm. and I know Mike Boyle spoke there, but I don't really remember what you spoke about. It's very...
It's internet stuff, for sure.
It's definitely internet stuff, mm-hmm. but there is definitely value shared, but I don't know that any of it helped me directly for where I was. And there was... there's tons of it that were, that's not even relevant anymore. The end, everything's changed. But, so... When I go to conferences or when I speak at conferences, I'm sure I want to share as much information and value as I can. But when I'm like standing on stage, looking out at the crowd, I'm not really looking at all the people scribbling, taking notes as fast as they can. I'm looking at the people who are leaning over and whispering to each other, because forming those bonds in that room with you and with David and with Jason and with Ryan McGinn and Elliot Hulse, those are the things that have massively propelled me. And when I run my mastermind, yes, I bring in amazing speakers like you and all of the other people who have been so kind to donate their time. And we teach the shit out of people. Yes, we help them write copy and build their businesses. But the thing that's most satisfying for me is when I see them form these alliances, these relationships that last a lifetime. One of my... former mastermind guys, a guy you know named Joey Persia.
Yeah, I hired Joey for some copy.
He's great. But when he joined the mastermind, he was trying to do fitness stuff. Yeah. And then he got, you know, and watching him make that pivot. But last July, Joey got married in Tulum, Mexico. He asked me to officiate the wedding, so I actually married him and Lauren. There were 75 people there. It's a destination wedding.
Yeah.
Of the 75 people, 9 of them were connected to the mastermind in some way. So that's over 10% of attendees. So when I say like I'm really excited to use the mastermind to help people build lifelong friendships and become like family, that's really, really what I care about. Helping people, you know, double and triple their income. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. That's amazing. I love doing that. It's great that, you know, Joey was struggling trying to do fitness stuff and now absolutely crushing it as a copywriter. I love that. But I love it more that he found 6 or 7 friends to invite to his wedding. And that's the stuff I get really passionate about.
Just like you and I found each other in a steakhouse in Tampa, Florida, nearly 10 years ago.
Precisely correct.
Thank you so much, John.
Got it, man.
What a show. Oh, wow. John and I could have kept going and going and going and diving deeper and deeper into John's depression and how he used stories to overcome his struggles. But quite frankly, we ran out of time. We had to go to pizza, to be honest with you. We were, after all, in New York City, and so we walked nearly an hour down the High Line to the famous Bleecker Street Pizza Shop in the West Village for a couple of slices, and it was well worth it. And so I can imagine that I will soon have John on again, because that's another story for another show. And now, our interview was also just a few days before another game-changing moment for him, because he was about to attend a Perfect Life workshop to help him navigate through a tough new phase of his life. So that's another reason we're going to have John back on the show. But please, in the meantime, let me know what you thought of today's episode. Head over to iTunes and give us a review and a 5-star ranking. And don't forget what we revealed in today's episode about storytelling is going to make a massive impact on the world, because you are now able to go out and share your story. As Roman says, one of the keys to success in life is having a coach for your health, your writing, and your work, and to live a perfect life. And it was actually because of John's depression that I started my morning message. This is a daily motivational and inspirational quote that goes out. It's free, and it arrives at 4 a.m. Eastern Standard Time every single day, 6 days a week. We take Sundays off. And I started this morning message years ago to help John get through that dark place in his life. So if you want to get the same message that goes to John and thousands of other subscribers, please go to themorningmessage.com today. All right. So it's amazing what that quote can do, and it's amazing what good coaching can do. It can lift you up, and it can take you higher and higher and higher, as it did for both John and myself. And that's why you need a coach, and that's why you need me as a coach, to walk you through a proven step-by-step blueprint for success, and also to get the accountability that I give to my clients. Like John, and like Super Bowl champion Steve Weatherford, and like female business owners like Shanda Sumter and Isabel De Los Rios, along with thousands of other entrepreneurs in dozens of industries. So let's get you started on your coaching journey, give you the accountability you need. Just visit perfectlifeworkshop.com today to apply to work with me at my next coaching event near you.